listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Oh, there we go. Now we got sound. Welcome to another Catch Them Doing Something Good edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, who's about to lose his voice, Alan Cardoza. Okay. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to noon, my guests and I bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. My guest today is the Executive Medical Director of Bay Recovery Center, Dr. Jerry Rand. Dr. Rand specializes in the treatment of chemical dependency and chronic pain with emphasis on OxyContin, heroin, and crystal meth. His process of listening, addressing, and executing a plan of action has enabled patients of all ages to achieve a quality of life which has been elusive to them up to that point. Dr. Rand, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy that you're having me on.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me, or should I put you on off speaker?
No. This is fine. It seems like my mic is down a little bit, and I've got it up as far as I can go. Okay. Anyway, let me, I kind of want to get to it right away because one of the questions that I have has to do with a quote that I've heard you say, and it intrigues me. So the quote is, you've said, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Can you explain kind of what that means?
Well, for many individuals that have chronic pain conditions, as tens of millions of Americans do, where they have some element of pain on a continuous basis and there is no cure for it, we know that some level of pain is inevitable. Most people have that as they age in general. But so when pain is inevitable, it's really what affects a person and their life and their family and their interactions, their work, and their ability to think and function is whether or not they're suffering from the pain. Pain and suffering are two different things. Many individuals that I treat come in a great deal of pain, and they're suffering, and they're miserable, and they're bedridden, and they're suicidal, and they leave with a high quality of life. They enjoy themselves. The pain doesn't interfere with their functioning or their social life anymore, and they can work again. But many individuals, when they focus on pain and that becomes the centerpiece of their life, and they focus on pain and they take drugs and more drugs, and then they have they spend their whole life focusing on the pain and solution for pain, they have no quality of life. So what you see is pain is one element of chronic pain, but suffering is the element that affects people so devastatingly that it can destroy their life. So they're really two separate things. And in treatment, you can separate the two. We have programs at Bay Recovery Centers and our pain track that written work, other things. We take people off certain medications or drugs or switch their medications, and we teach them psychological ways of dealing with pain so that they're clear-headed and they function. We also know that narcotics in general for many Americans increase pain and the perception of pain. And a certain percentage of people, the pills that they're on that they think is helping them is increasing their pain more than it's decreasing it. So they're really suffering from medication. Now, the side effects of medications are, particularly the long-term opiates, are sleeplessness, restlessness, anxiety, fatigue, irritability, cognitive dysfunction where they have difficulty thinking, their memories are impaired, their inability, they become unable to socialize, they have neuroendocrine problems, which means that Many of their endocrine functions, such as testosterone or estrogen, are decreased. So they have they lose their ability to have sex or interact or smile. So frequently, the medication that we use creates a great many problems that cause suffering in the end. At Bay Recovery Centers, we have many ways of removing those. There's newer medications that can stabilize that situation, reduce pain, and then there's many psychological ways to stabilize an individual so that the pain doesn't interfere. Tonight I'll be on TV on A&E intervention show. I'll be on this week and next about pain patients. So you might be interested in learning how pain drastically affects the whole family unit.
Well, and that's actually part of our thinking on this. But now it sounds to me like what you're saying is that many of the people you've tied in the correlation between chemical dependency and actual pain or pain management. Now, are a lot of the people that are now addicted to drugs, you know, is that because they have started out with pain and they've started taking the drugs to dull the pain? Now they've added an addiction to the same situation.
That's correct. Well, but it can occur both ways. Many individuals, when they have pain, are started on medications. The medications in the opiate class or narcotics are by themselves, they form tolerance and dependence. Now, tolerance means you need more and more to do the same effect, and dependence means that you have withdrawal symptoms when you try to stop it. Now, that evolves into numerous changes in both the biology and the physiology of the brain, its chemistry, and its cellular makeup. So in many individuals, drug becomes addictive. Addiction is really a complicated term. I hesitate to use that. Addiction has, in the end, an implication of abuse and loss of control and inability to handle drugs, which is the later stages. But it's the issue of pain in these individuals that starts them on that road with medications that become interfering with their life.
Okay, now,
it's also true that many people are abusing drugs or have taken drugs or have prior history of family issues or genetic issues that predispose them towards addiction. And when they have pain, starting these drugs on people that have already been abusing drugs is the same as giving them heroin. It just escalates into a much greater problem.
Now, what percentage of these people are dealing with a more of a physical pain versus a psychological pain?
Well, there is a percentage of people that just taking the opiates themselves will have a perception of pain. They'll have muscle pain and aching and back pain. That's true for almost anybody on heroin or one of those drugs. So when you realize taking people off heroin relieves those symptoms, one also realizes that a certain percentage of people taking pain pills, their pain may actually, the original pain may be gone, and they may experience the side effects of the drugs which cause muscle pains and aches. So there is a certain percentage of people that are, so for example, postoperatively after a knee surgery or shoulder surgery, that will have generalized aching and pain once they're on the medication, and just by stopping it, it'll go away. So the medication themselves can cause pain. There is delusional pain disorders, and again, tonight I'm on TV on a patient with a delusional pain disorder, so the perception really gets exacerbated and reaches a level that's way out of proportion to any reality.
Well, explain what you mean by delusional pain.
Delusional would mean that the person perceives they're in pain and they amplify every characteristic of pain and every movement of pain. So the patient I'm in question couldn't sit anywhere, touch anything, get near any computers or cell phones, and would scream in pain because they would have generalized bodily pain. And that was amplified by a delusional disorder and a perception that wasn't real to a considerable extent. But I think for general purposes, one realizes that the psychiatric or psychological makeup of a person influences how they tolerate once it occurs. And people that are quite stable emotionally and psychologically transition through pain and operations fairly easily without succumbing to the chronic forces of pain. Other people that have predisposed by psychiatric issues or family of origin issues, the traumas is when children are traumatized with beaten, abused, rape, incest, or any significant trauma that creates a predisposition later allows them, when they're in pain, for the pain to become intolerable and on a level that nothing seems to resolve. So their pain becomes out of control and they go from place to place looking for a solution and nothing really works, even the higher doses of drugs, so the drug becomes the problem at the end.
Okay.
It's a very complicated issue. Up to 80 million Americans are on pain pills, which is five times more per individual than are in England. In this country, the number of people on opiates rose dramatically in the 90s and the early 2000s, and drugs today like OxyContin are epidemic. And if we're going to talk about the teens and the adolescents, I have a great deal to say on how that's evolving at this point and why it's occurring.
Right, and I definitely want to talk about that. But let's talk about that statistic when you said that there's 80 million people in the United States. I mean, what do you attribute that to? I mean, and it's five times more than England. I mean, you know, I don't believe that we have five times more pain. Is it because here we have commercials for it on television? Is it here because of our health system? I mean, what do you attribute it to in comparison to the rest of the world?
It's a good question. What I'm going to say is that there are multiple factors that influence the number of medications that are written to individuals in the United States. Some is couched in good quality care. Every person's entitled to good pain relief. There were some lawsuits in the early 90s where patients were undertreated for pain and they were sued, and those lawsuits went to the patients for not getting enough pain pills. It's also true that in the early 90s, we came out with medications that, like OxyContin, which is you can now get 16 Percocet pills in one without the Tylenol. So we came out with medications with much larger doses of medication in them and much stronger, which originally were used for terminal cancer patients, but they became used for the general population of treating pain.
Right.
What happened in this country is a lot of commercialism has occurred, which has certainly spread the word, the TV ads, the use of these medications, and they're powerful, and that it's epidemic today, OxyContin and some of the drugs. Mm-hmm. And San Diego just set up a task force for it, and other countries have. But the United States is unique in the fact that a drug like Vicodin, 99% of the world's hydrocodone is written in the United States only. Many of these drugs outside of a hospital, doctors wouldn't use in other countries or in Europe, which is considered in many ways higher quality medicine than here.
Right, but see, what I'm trying to find out is that it's sort of the, you know, the what came first, the chicken or the egg. You know, in other words, you know, is it because we have so much advertising? Because I know when I'm in other countries, and I'm talking to people. I was in Croatia not too long ago, and I was talking with some of the locals, and they were laughing about how ridiculous they believe American television is. And in fact, they went so far as to say that, you know, that they can't believe that our commercials are dominated by, and they named pain medication, you know, erection medication, it just seemed ridiculous to them, and they just couldn't understand why, American television had all of this. So I guess my question is that are we planting the psychological seed with our advertising to suggest to everybody that, you need it for the slightest little pain?
I think to answer your question is the advertising is one component of a large marketing campaign by the drug companies. The drug companies are one of the biggest companies in the world if you look on the stock market.
Right.
There's $150 billion worth of pain treatment in this country. The market for these medications and the profit is extensive. So what's occurred is not only that the advertising has made it easily available, so when a patient goes to a doctor, they ask for the medication because it's on TV, like asking for any other brand name. That's one component. The other component is the sales of drugs is to its distribution chain is sold by salesmen that go to doctors' offices and sell. Many doctors are teach for the pharmaceutical companies, as I do in some medications that I believe in. So these companies are so wealthy that so many prominent doctors speak for them that they became proponents of the use of these drugs. So they focused on the real need for these drugs. So there is a need for the drugs, but it's that carried to such an extreme, it's actually epidemic. And the other issue that occurs is not only that doctors speak for the company, the economics of it, once a patient's on some of these drugs, you can't stop it. People become so dependent immediately that patients come back over and over. It actually gives the appearance that a doctor's busy, that the patients like the doctor and the medication, so they keep coming back. So first appearance is that everything's going okay. Patients like it. They keep coming back. Doctor's happy. He's busy. But the end result is that these drugs in the later stages, which is not later stages, is actually pretty quick, have a huge number of problems from these medications. We know today that up to 43% of all people on medications have what's called aberrant drug-related behavior, which are numerous behaviors that evolve on these drugs, and the medications themselves are so interfering. So the economics in this country is... I'd say the downside for me would be likening it to the real estate market that got out of control. I believe that the medications and the drug companies are out of control.
All right. Well, you know, now, and I've done some checking, and one of the things that I learned is I learned that some of the most world-renowned pain specialists are sending some of their most difficult patients to you. Now, why is that, and what are you doing that they're not?
Well, I've been doing this for several years, many years, in fact. What I've noted over the years is that since 1990, when I started doing this, is that pain pills clearly affect pain by increasing it and upregulating it. Pain pills also cause hyperalgesia, which means the pain pill in itself, every time you give it, actually upregulates pain. So it makes pain a higher intensity just by giving the medication. I have a great deal of experience at this, and I've been doing this since the early 90s. Most of the research in the field regarding pain pills and their upregulation of pain and their adverse effects really come into play around the year 2000, when it became common knowledge.
Right, but if
I've treated probably 8,000 people. It's almost counterintuitive for many doctors to treat patients and once they're on pain pills, by stopping the pain pills as a component of treatment. You know, our center offers a variety of medical specialists. We have expertise in the treatment and diagnosis of pain. I know a pain syndrome is different when you look at it on a medication like a narcotic and off of it. So many of the drugs are actually creating a pain syndrome that is being treated by other doctors, and they don't see that component of it. It's like they're really in the eyes of the beholder. So it's a great deal of experience to realize that the drug is enhancing or creating the problem. People come from around the world here because we have that experience. I have a staff that's been trained doing this for many years. We've treated thousands and thousands of patients. Today, other centers are opening up around the country treating pain. They don't have that background or expertise, but the knowledge base and the research regarding pain pills and their adverse effects is very clear today. Pain pills cause so many negative problems and create so much, and there's so much illness that you can attribute to the pain pills in the end. You just have to be able to see that and to be able to change that, subtract the illness from the drugs, be able to treat the patient successfully.
Okay, well, what it sounds like you're saying is that, you know, half the problem is the drugs that they're on. So one of the things that you're doing that's different is you're taking them off a lot of those drugs. You're stripping them off that. I just want to take a specific situation, okay? Now, when I was 19 years old, I fell off of a roof. I herniated two discs in my back. There was a variety of different approaches of what people wanted to take. There was the orthopedic surgeon that immediately wanted to perform an operation. The operation was going to cost, like $60,000, and they were going to go in and do a fusion on my back. At 19 years old, I thought, this just didn't make sense to me. Now, there was another doctor who felt that you could just mask it with pain medication. And there was also the physical therapy side of it, which literally meant to let it rest and then build it back up and strengthen everything around it. Now, as time went on, they said that I still had a bit of a problem. And they said that, you could now, because of the changes, you could now go in and do a laminectomy and you're just going to shave it. Now, I chose not to get the operation because I don't believe in cutting unless you absolutely have to. But I also chose to stay away from the drugs and let my body tell us what we could and couldn't do. Now, it sounds a little bit like that's what you're doing with your patients.
Well, when I treat patients initially, I don't recall any patients that I've gotten on to those kind of pain medications over time. We do know that initial pain treatment from an initial injury does require medication. Doing surgery does require medication.
Sure.
An acute fall, an acute injury. There's nothing wrong with starting someone on medication, but medication should be a short-term solution to the acute incident. What's happened is that many individuals aren't as smart as you are. That once they take the pain pills and they have some persistent pain, they continue using that as their major mechanism of treating their problem. And if they're predisposed, the drug itself becomes a problem. Predisposed meaning genetically and environmentally and psychologically. So it's best not to get involved with the drugs. That's because then you become dependent on the drugs to treat the pain, and then you get all the side effects of the drugs. When you mention that I treat people by taking people off the drugs, stripping them off drugs, that in an early stage, one, it's relatively easy to stop drugs. As time goes on, it becomes quite complicated. In fact, many individuals, you can't strip off drugs after 20, 30 years on drugs. You have to learn other ways to stabilize their neurophysiology, their physiological system. And we have actually good medications today to stabilize these patients after long-term insults on that have occurred over time. So a lot of what I do and what we do at Bay Recovery Centers is that we're able to utilize the newer medications to remove the side effects of drugs. The word detoxification sort of paradoxically means in the medical dictionary, it means to remove the toxic effects of drugs.
Sure.
It doesn't necessarily mean to remove the drugs. Today, we can actually remove the toxicity of many of the earlier drugs by using some of the newer things. But my preference is never to get a person involved on high-dose drugs initially. After the initial use, we'd like to get people off drugs immediately so they don't have long-term consequences of drugs. That being said, there's no question that many people have severe pain problems also that have to be dealt with effectively. And our motto at Bay Recovery is always to treat the pain and make a person comfortable. And I found in my experience that no matter where a person's at and what kind of problem, that there is a way of doing that, improve the quality of their life, stabilize them, no matter how far down the path they've gone and how many drugs they've been on.
All right. We are talking with Dr. Jerry Rand, and we are talking about pain. We are talking about chemical dependency and the correlation between them. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Jerry, if you could kind of walk us through, and I think a lot of the either professionals out there or parents, I mean, they really don't know what happens when their loved one goes to a program like yours. So if we could take a typical case, and maybe you could choose one, either somebody who is in for heroin or meth or something, if you can walk us through a particular case. In the meantime, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in about 1 minute.
Thanks.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back. And again, you're listening to Answers for the Family. And I want to announce something. We have a new blog. The new blog is www.answers4thefamilyblog.com. I'd really like to have everybody go view the detail. You can go there, view the details on upcoming guests and future shows. You can comment on today's show. I'd like people, listeners, to go on and suggest guests and topics for the future, and know that you can listen to any of our past shows. So again, please give us your feedback. That's what helps us know what you want. Now, Dr. Rand.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So walk us through a particular case so that, again, those people that have had a loved one that, you know, in this day and age, a lot of people know, and in fact, with the television show that you're on intervention, you know, people know that, you know, that there is an intervention, that one of their loved ones goes off to a treatment program, but I don't know that they know exactly what happens. Can you walk us through a typical, if there is a typical?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It might be best if I gave you two typicals, one of somebody in pain with a drug problem, and one who has a drug problem that pain is not the primary thing, but it looks the same.
That would be great.
Both types, because the opiates are now epidemic in the adolescent group, so they're easy to describe. I'll utilize one of our pain patients that was on TV, actually. Was one of the number one shows that we did. It was a young lady who was a cheerleader who was having problems at the age of 18 with rheumatoid arthritis. She developed a crippling case of arthritis of the joint. She went from there to being dependent and addicted to the narcotic group of drugs, the OxyContins, the Norcos, the Vicodins, and the tranquilizer group of drugs, the sleeping pills, and the Soma, which is a muscle relaxant tranquilizer. And the benzodiazepines, the Valium, Librium, Klonopin, Ativan group of drugs, and the Ambiens, which are the sleeping pills. Those are all benzodiazepines. So what happened to her over the next several years is that her rheumatoid arthritis continued unremitting to destroy her joints. She went on to pass out and have blackouts all the time, found by her family and friends, unconscious, hospitalized several times. in both treatment centers for addiction and in the hospital for pain on IVs months at a time for crippling arthritis. Her joints were big, red, and swollen. She came to us after about 10 years and after a family intervention where the family half were so angry at her about her addiction that they'd never talk to her again. And the other half realized that she was ill and dying from a crippling disease. Mm-hmm. In fact, she had both. So she was addicted to drugs, acting addictively on drugs, and her medical disease, she was in severe pain. One of her knees looked like a basketball. It was red, swollen, tender. She couldn't walk anymore. So what we did when she got to Bay Recovery is transitioned her off the tranquilizer group of drugs first and by treating her sleep correctly. We have a sleep program at Bay Recovery. We have a functional restoration program with a physical therapist, acupuncture, massage, a full rehab team. We do yoga, movement therapy. We restore motion and function. We also have the psychological pain program for pain with workbooks on how to deal with pain and the psychological effects of pain and how they integrate. And in this case, we used medication such as a drug called buprenorphine, which is a newer opiate that is used more so around the world than in the United States for chronic pain. It's actually one of the drugs that it's a world consensus to use this in the chronic older patients because it doesn't have immunosuppression like the other narcotics opiates do. So in fact, when I switched her to a newer opiate that's used theoretically for addiction, but around the world for pain and other reasons, I was able to put her rheumatoid arthritis in remission for the first time in 10 years.
Good.
An active crippling disorder was actually being caused by the drugs she was on. Now, this becomes a very complicated issue in this country because that's standard care for somebody like that. And in fact, probably the biggest contributing cause for her ongoing illness was the drug that is considered the correct treatment. So we were able to put her rheumatoid arthritis in remission. We were able to start treating her medication using some substitute medications and the newer opiate that I mentioned, which doesn't have those side effects. We went on to replace both her knees and one shoulder.
Wow.
And because they were already eaten away, she has some other problems. But today she's a functional, active member of society. She's happy. She laughs. She enjoys her life. She didn't want to live that way. What presents itself in this scenario is how the world looks at a patient like this. Many people would see her as a pure drug addict who's down and out, just eating drugs and out of control. The medical world and her family, many of them, looked at her as she was, which is an ill person who had a devastating, crippling illness that was eating away her joints and causing severe pain.
Okay, now, what was eating away her joints? The drugs or the illness?
No, the rheumatoid arthritis is an active inflammatory autoimmune disorder where your immune system eats away your own joints. Now, we have, you've seen rheumatoid arthritis on TV with people with crippled hands and, mm-hmm. and joints. It's not aging arthritis. It's an active disease that can be stopped today. We have numerous chemotherapies for it. She had been on numerous ones, but nothing had stopped it because her immune system was out of control. So the drug itself was contributing to her illness. So in reality, she had an illness that was shortening her life and destroying her joints, mm-hmm. which we were able to stop that part of it.
Right.
So to say not to give somebody who's screaming in pain, not to give them drugs, is actually cruel and inhuman.
Sure.
But it's not okay that person abuses the drugs either. So what's happened is, and this we see all the time at the recovery centers, is we see people that actually have genuine pain and genuine problem with drugs, and we're able to stabilize that difficult combination. Some years ago, as a matter of fact, as little as 3 or 4 years ago, there's probably nobody else in the country who would even attempt to do that. Today it's general common knowledge that these drugs interfere with certain healing and effects. But But we were able to stabilize a chronic illness. She's now 28 years old. She's stable. She was literally dying from that disease. We were able to actually do the surgery, keep her stable on medication during the surgery and after surgery, and she's leading a relatively normal life, given the fact that she's had all this trauma.
Well, and
so that is a
right.
You know,
and what you're saying is
everything we have. We have a team of 40 people in all phases of treatment: psychology, surgery, pain management, addiction management, medical specialists, physical therapists, acupuncturists, movement therapists, a group of psychologists, psychiatrists. It took everything to help this individual. It takes a whole team of people, and that's why we see people come from around the country, because we have all those things here.
That's, you know,
that's one example of what you see. Another example is, did you want me to go to the next example?
Sure. I mean, but what I was going to say is that I think that sort of answers the question that I had earlier, which I thought was really important, and that was, you know, why are some specialists, and some of which that I spoke to, that said that, you know, they refer their toughest patients to you, and now I think that kind of answers it in the sense that it is a full team. I mean, you know, I was sort of amazed, as you were saying, that, I mean, besides the fact of dealing with the psychological aspect of it, dealing with, you know, the actual physical pain, the changing of medication, but to do two knee replacements and a shoulder replacement, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Pretty amazing. We do cutting-edge practice here. The medications that we use are cutting-edge. The ability to change, transition from one to another is very difficult, which creates a great deal of problems for most people. It's near impossible in another setting to actually change a person's medications like hers. It would be considered cruel and inhuman punishment. You have to be able not to change the medication. You have to be able to rotate without and make her feel better as you're changing it. So
right.
It's not taking away the medication, it's rotating it. So the primary treatment was always with her, was to keep her out of pain while we were stabilizing her, which is a great deal different than just saying, just stop the drugs and they'll be better. And that's why today, even the vast majority of pain patients that are depend on drugs are treated in a fashion where they're just ripped off drugs, and their pain becomes such a predominant problem that they go back on drugs. So it's still, in the general picture of things, is a back and forth game that tens of millions of people are not getting any relief or treatment for.
Now, would it be correct? Would you agree that maybe another description of that would be that at the same time in which you're weaning them off of one or more drugs that they're already on, you're filling in with something else? I mean, is that kind of a pretty good picture?
Yes, I think from a medical standpoint, it's being able to transition, to move. The drugs are very complicated. They work on multiple receptors and internal endorphin and chemical systems. So the idea is to transition, to stabilize the system as you're rotating, rather than just rip somebody off. You want to be able to stabilize the disease. And in this instance, we were able to stabilize rheumatoid arthritis that she'd been to several universities, had all the good treatment there was, but nobody could stop the disease itself. So one has to be able to understand the physiology of how drugs work and be able to rotate them and shut off the negative effects and the negative consequences that are so common with these medications.
All right. Now, before you give us the other, and I don't want to run out of time, we did get it. We had a listener question that came in that said to please ask him about Michael Jackson and his pain medication issues. Can you know, that's something that obviously was very, very big in the news. I think it's things that people had a lot of curiosity towards. Tell us a little bit about that based on what you've seen of what you believe that he was going through.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Michael Jackson certainly had a pain problem dating back some 20 years. I think probably when he had his plastic surgeries and his burn, I believe he got exposed to opiates and narcotics and pain pills back then, and went on to take vast amounts of medications. I was told up to $100,000 a month of prescription medication, which I believe because one of the patients I treated came in on $70,000 a month of prescription pain pills when I treated them, just on pain pills. So,
let me interject real quick. I mean, you know, also in the news, you know, is information in regards to the other doctor. Now, I'm not going to ask you to specifically say in that situation, but, you know, in the situation you mentioned about the 70,000 or in these, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90, $100,000 a month habits, at what point are these doctors committing a crime?
That's a very difficult question. Some of it's a societal question and a perception question. If the general tenor of the times is to use these drugs in massive quantities, as it has been in the United States, then you're faced with the reality of whose fault is that? I've treated many patients on huge amounts of drugs like this, and the difficulty of taking care of somebody on that amount of drugs is unbelievably complicated and life-threatening. So what happened to him over the years, and it happens to many people I've treated, and I see this over and over, is that they get on more and more drugs. So instead of when you have somebody on $30,000 to $50,000 or $70,000 worth of prescription pain pills a month, you have to realize these medicines are toxic, that you can't just stop them without the patient dying. You can't just stop that kind of medication anymore. So I've gotten referrals from several universities around the country like this. You see them with patients that have had bad diseases, or I have had cancer patients that have been cured from cancer. Now they're left with this amount of drugs. And that amount of drugs that somebody's on, nobody knows what to do with. Or I wouldn't say nobody, because that's why they're sent here. That problem could take 6 months to a year to solve at the end. It becomes so intense. So as many of our patients have to stay several months to stabilize their system again. So what happened is that over time, what was being considered good care for a private patient was to give them more and more drugs. Someone somewhere along the line should have put a stop to it. At the end, what happened with Michael Jackson is he ended up on such huge quantities of drugs and narcotics and whatever other drugs he was on, is that he could no longer sleep because the sleep center, which is in the hypothalamus of the brain, and I treat sleep disorders at Bay Recovery because they're commonly associated with this, the sleep center doesn't work. So the narcotics or pain pills like Vicodin or OxyContin, et cetera, over time on big enough doses, it really just paralyzes that center. So what you saw with Michael Jackson, he could no longer sleep. So they started resorting to drugs to put him to sleep, and I'm sure he went through the whole litany of sleeping pills and tranquilizers. But to do that, you have to realize he still has to get up in the morning to go to work, to go on tour, so they had to find a drug that was short enough to knock him out, because his brain no longer works to sleep, to knock him out, to make him unconscious for a few hours and to wake him up and put him on stage in the morning. And they resorted, in this instance, to a general anesthetic drug that you use for surgery to put somebody to sleep for 4 hours to do surgery. You had to use a drug that potent to put him asleep, and you had to use a drug that leaves the system that quick to wake him up. So what happened with him, and this happens with many patients, is their sleep disorder in the end is so profound. And 95% of the patients we treat at Bay Recovery have sleep disorders, which is probably the worst fear they have in the end, is they can't sleep. Their sleep center just doesn't work anymore. It's been knocked out by the tranquilizers and the narcotic medication. So in the end, he couldn't sleep. So he went, and he could have gone anywhere, and I'm sure he did. He went looking for a solution to stay on the drugs, but to find a way to sleep, and ended up using an anesthetic drug that he essentially died from. He died from sleep apnea and heart failure that comes from the low oxygenation from those combinations. So it's the inevitable end result of massive doses of these pain pills.
Right, but again, your center, if I understand you right, you said you have a sleep program. There. In other words, if a doctor is aware of this, is aware of a program like yours, I mean, at what point is it malpractice to continue to keep them on $70,000 or $100,000 worth of pills a month and keep them in their care, which is probably lining their own pockets, versus having them go to a program where they know that they can get help.
The term malpractice implies what is used in the community or what community standards are. We're in San Diego, which is a highly evolved city, and I've taught numerous times around the city to pain doctors and physicians and institutions. And so the level of knowledge is high. But there's many parts of the country where what I'm saying doctors have never even heard. I treat doctors from there. They have nobody there that knows this. So once a doctor is informed and has knowledge about this, then it's his obligation to do something about
it. That's what I'm saying. And before we run out of time, I know I want to touch on a couple of things. One of is that if anybody has any additional questions or whatever, I mean, let's talk about how they can get a hold of you, how they can get information on Bay Recovery, and also share again what time you're going to be on intervention. Share that in case anybody wants to see that as well.
Well, I'm Dr. Rand, R-E-N-D. My first name's Jerry, J-R-Y. We're in San Diego. It's called... I direct Bay Recovery Centers. That's by the bay in San Diego, overlooking the ocean and bay. And we can be found, you can look us up online. Our phone number is 800-375-7263.
All right. Here, and let me give the website address as well. The website is www.bayrecovery.com. That's bay as in B-A-Y. Recovery, RECOVERY.com. So again, if you have any additional questions, either go to the website or make the call. And Jerry, we're just about out of time, so just one last thing. You said you're going to be on, I think it's tonight, on intervention.
On the show is Intervention on A&E. It's at 9 o'clock. It's their 100th show. It's their new show. They're kicking off their new season. I'll be on their 100th and their 101st show. It'll be at 9 o'clock on your local stations.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much again. I'm sorry we are just out of time, but I appreciate you coming on and sharing this with us. I think it's a critical issue, and actually I would have liked to have talked a little more as it relates to our teens, but again, it is a critical issue out there. Everybody, think about it. You can be as addicted to prescription medication as you can anything else on the street.
Alex, I want to thank you for having me on, and I hope we can do this again. I didn't have the opportunity to tell you how this affects adolescents, which I know
right.
that you want to know about, and how that's become epidemic, and how that's evolving, and how many of those people we treat. So I hope we have the opportunity to talk more.
I hope so as well. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye now.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.